This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy to welcome to the Radio Cafe Martin Prechtel. He's an author, he's an artist, he's founder of the school Bolad's Kitchen, and his new book is The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. He will be speaking tonight, Wednesday, July 15th, at 7 o'clock at the Embudo Valley Library in Dixon, New Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, thank you very much for letting me come over here.
It's wonderful to have you. It's a profound book and very interesting book, and it's full of not only ideas, but really great stories, which I hope we can talk about a little bit. But it's a book, as it says in the subtitle, about grief and praise. In many ways, it's about what we don't do, about how we numb ourselves against feeling grief in this society. How did you come to write this particular book?
Well, grief and praise, I was raised in New Mexico in an Indian town, you know, and at an early age I ended up by hook or by crook in Guatemala. And the people that I ended up living with in the Tzu Hill Maya people, they're very powerful praisers, very heavy, eloquent speakers in their own native tongue. And that includes when someone dies or when they lose, you know, a whole part of their fields to a hurricane or whatever it is. The grief and praise were always constants together. Everybody lived in such a way that they were inseparable. I didn't really notice that at the time, to be honest. We just sort of lived it. But then when I came, you know, there was a lot of warfare and stuff. You know, I was there for over a decade, and there was a lot of warfare, and I returned back to the States. And when I got back to New Mexico, you know, things were what they were, but I ended up on the road teaching at some point or another. And during that time, I was in a certain amount of demand in different parts of the world. And at one point, I was headed to, I believe it was St. Paul, Minnesota, to go do a talk on gang violence and conflict and all this stuff we were working with. And I stopped off in Chicago to go to a funeral of a father of a friend of mine. And I didn't really actually know the man that well, but I went to, you know, and they were Irish Americans. So I was expecting, okay, there's going to be a certain amount of whiskey here, and a lot of weeping and storytelling and awake, and nada. No, nada. They were just totally talking about their NASDAQ and their stock market portfolios, and they had their little suits and ties. The guy's name was hardly ever mentioned. We didn't even know that somebody had died. I was like, did I get to the wrong place? What's going on here? So me, like, you know, being what I was, and still a little bit like that. Now I'm not quite so forthright, but I started to do what I would normally do for someone who died, because the belief where I come from is that if not enough grief is expended for the person who's passed away, then their soul becomes stranded and can't get where it needs to go. So I'm, you know, doing this. You always have to have a tree, you know. So there was a tree out in this garden, and I was doing this, and I was pouring some beer there and making my prayer, and this guy came up and he literally kicked me in the ribs. A guy with a suit and a tie, you know, stockbroker, like, started beating me up. And because the grief was so close to the surface of his skin, that all of this praise was just like, he exploded and did exactly what it talks about in the book, where grief is so quickly turned to violence. So, you know, I looked at that, and my mind, all of a sudden, the switch flipped on. I said, yeah, these guys can't praise, and therefore they can't grieve. And because the Irish are not known for not praising. I mean, I cut some on my side, so I talk so much. But they're amazing praisers, you know, given their natural way of being. But so the next day when I had to speak, I spoke about grief and praise as being a source of possibility when it's lacking of conflict with people and of violence, extreme violence. So, of course, this is being recorded, and there's an old rocker running the board, you know, it's all these people, and he put his dat in, you know, the old dat, and he started to record it just out of habit, and I wasn't paying attention. He was hard of hearing, and some guy noticed it, and he actually took the dat at the end of the evening without anybody seeing it and went off and bootlegged thousands of copies and was selling them all over the world, unbeknownst to me. And then someone sent me one, and he sent me one that said, hey, you should hear this guy. He's really intelligent. This is a beautiful thing that he's saying. And I said, well, that's me. What are you talking about? And then it became somewhat, you know, kind of an underground thing, and people realized it was me, and they were sending me love letters and all this. And I was just amazed. So I listened. It was terrible, terrible recording, by the way. And it wouldn't be anything that I would myself want to sell, per se. But after a while, I found the guy who did it. And I said, just keep doing it. It's fine. And just keep the money and give to these kids. We're involved in these programs in the neighborhoods. So after a while, he got bored with that, and he gave it back to me. And so as I was traveling around, some guy called me from NAB, you know, North Atlantic Press, when I was doing some gigs on the West Coast, Richard Grossinger. Well, I was very tired, I remember one night. And he said, I want you to write a book. I want to represent you as a publisher. I said, oh, well, that's great, but I'm so tired right now, I can't even possibly fathom that I will have the credentials to write a book on that subject. So someday maybe we'll talk. So he said, I'll tell you what, I'll keep all your books that you've ever written in print, and I'll publish other books that you want to publish if you eventually write a book on grief and faith. So here it is. I eventually wrote one.
And that's an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah, and so it's very small compared to what I originally wrote. I mean, it's 9 pickup trucks manuscript, but I cut it back because it was too much Martin pontification. I want to make something a little more useful.
Well, I mean, what's so interesting about it is that, I mean, the idea that there are bad things that happen when we don't grieve, and there are amazing things that happen when we do grieve, and that transformation, or as you call it, like metabolism of grief into beauty, of grief into praise. What, first of all, what do you even mean when you use the word praise?
Well, that's the whole book right there. The book's actually about praise more than it is about grief, because they're inseparable as far as I'm concerned. The praise isn't like, you know, when somebody says, oh, yeah, you've got a really nice outfit on or something. I mean, yeah, that's praise. The praise is really something much deeper. It's the same as grief, because grief is for only things that you love when you've lost them. And a lot of things, people think, oh, that's when I crash my car, you know, or I lose my money on the stock market, or if there's something I think I deserve I didn't get. But that's not really what I'm talking about here. So I define grief as basically being the what happens naturally, to what should happen when you have deep loss of something or someone or a place or a country that you love. And therefore, the expression of the grief become the greatest praise you can show. Because imagine you losing what you love, and then, you know, you're just sitting there. Something's dying in you when that happens. It's got to go somewhere, this beautiful expression. And sometimes it comes out really weird when it first starts, but if you're with people that understand this, you realize that the grief expression of a person is totally in praise of the fact that you lived long enough to love. And so then, on the other hand, when you're living a life, you know, people's lives now are very mechanical and, you know, a little bit distanced from the ground, but it doesn't have to be, then you start to realize that everything good that's come to you, you know, all your food, all your fiber, the way you're able to transport yourself and communicate and everything, comes at great grief to the ground, great grief to other people who are slaving to dig it out of the ground, like in a cell phone, with all the collodium in the Congo, and, you know, all of these things. There's an enormous grief for all of the benefit, happiness that you have. So old shaman, you know, they were saying they're mostly not going around praying like to make somebody well, but in order to heal the rift that people cause in the world by the stealing from it. So you're always constantly praising the fact that this thing will go through this much grief, that this earth would allow itself to be plowed with steel, that this much life could come out, and all just to give you another day of life. So you have to praise it. And that's where I come from. You have to praise it. So whether you're grieving what you have lost, and if you're doing it well, or if the people, it's not a single thing, communal thing, if you're doing well, then you're praising. And then the everyday life of having to praise what has already been given to you, which most people say to recognize your blessings, but you have to say something about it or do something about it. So praise, you know, not to be Irish and long-winded here, which I am, but by nature, is the fact that it's not just speaking, it's the way you move through the life, the way you treat one another, the way you build your buildings. I mean, the way you walk and talk and do everything, the way you make your tea, the way you speak with your children, and the lack of it is the lack of those things. So I write a lot about that in here, you know, because as we were saying earlier, it's not all-encompassing. But certainly it seemed to be a radical idea to everybody that those two things went together. Matter of fact, when we were publishing, the marketing team said, well, you can't leave this on the title. Nobody knows what it means. I said, well, that's why I wrote a book about it, so they can open it and read it and maybe see what it might mean, you know. Get an idea, read it.
I think it's such an important piece of this question of this book, the fact that, as you said, I mean, look at all the objects that are on this table and sitting around us that were made by people whose names and places we'll never know, who have suffered to make these things. Mm-hmm. The earth has been extracted from to make these things.
Right.
And these things we take for granted, and they're beautiful to us, and they're useful to us. And it's almost like if we were to know and to feel each of these things, we'd almost have to be grieving full time.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, grief cannot remain in sorrow, and that's why what you should be doing instead of grieving full time is praising full time, which is what natural cultures do. And they, you know, anybody from an outside culture who wants these people to get up with the progressive nature of the modern world wants to get rid of that. That's the first thing they try to get rid of, is that time-consuming ritual praise of life so as to get on to getting ahead. And so grief in itself is not so much sitting around weeping all the time. I mean, that's part of, definitely, you know, when you lose somebody or something you love, you have that. But it doesn't stay there. It moves along. And so the praise that one is capable of making is also pretty innocuous in a culture that doesn't remember all this. I invent a whole school for that. That's all this school is. Everybody says, well, you got this crazy school I keep hearing about. It's like, I don't really understand what it's about. So, well, no, nobody really does. But what it is to find out where everything comes from, know the origins of them, and be able to address that in some small, tiny grain of sand way. So praise and grief of all the things. That, like your board here, that would take 20,000 years to even figure out where everything came from, much less praise all of the processes of centuries of people inventing and all of the magic minds of people. You know, I mean, it's beyond belief. I mean, you drive your car, you would have to know everything about every titanium and every collodion and every cobalt, the origins of, you know, the cylinders and the rings and all of the different compounds that are killing everybody that are in there. Yeah, you just crank up and you go. You don't even say thanks to the motor. But a psychologist said, well, you're crazy. You're thanking your truck. But if you're an Indian, you thank your truck, man. It's like your pony, you know. You're not just jumping down killing him. You know how it works. And nowadays, praise is mostly in order to get more work out of somebody. I mean, let's face it. You know, you'd say something nice about so-and-so so that they do a better job. But no, you're right. Yes, I mean, if we ever sat down, just look at the plastic on the cover of a thing, which I ask my students to do, and that's what the investigations are. You know.
Yeah.
And in themselves, where they're from, in their own bodies and lives, you know, many forget.
Mm. You were talking about how when there's a kind of shift to modern life, people are asked to give up these time-consuming rituals. And for you, as somebody who lived in Mayan Guatemala, and you know, you were very much part of the society there, what did that look like? What did a day of ritual and praise look like?
Well, I have to say that when I showed up in Guatemala, that was already in an advanced state of distress. But nonetheless, there was an enormous amount of intactness within the tribal community, which is a very large village. There's over 40,000 people. I mean, 28,000 when I first lived there. Now it's 42,000. But it's pretty much, these things I talk about are a little bit hard to find these days. But what it looked like, it's not so much what it looked like, it's just every. I mean, you get up in the morning. First of all, you got to get up before the morning, because the idea is to understand the stories. And this is what everything is based on. You have to have stories. And the stories are not something that you take or leave. They're like what you might say, the skeletal structure of the psyche of the people. So, like, you're not going to get up after the sun comes up, because the sun is struggling and dying as he comes up, and he needs you to be up early to keep him from dying. So everybody who's traditional gets up, they have these, women are getting the cooking fires going, the men are bringing this, getting ready to go out in the bush, and they take the coals and they put these different gifts that they have and put the smoke to the sun so he can breathe in. And then they say these very eloquent phrases, these old ladies, men are the best of it, you know, old guys are good too. And the little kids are getting good at it, but they're getting good at it really early. I mean, you know, like when they're 3 years old, they could outdo me. When I arrived in the village, I was like a moron, you know, like I'm talking, I'm trying to learn, and then I did. And it's just this gorgeous thing to keep the sun alive, and then the winds, and then the water, which is they're considered the daughter of the moon, and which they get all their water and all their life really comes from this lake they live. So this constant praise, every rock has a name. You know, all these tourists used to come and sit on these rocks at the edge of the lake, and there was some old lady would come out with a rock and be giving them hell, you know, and he says, what? This rock is such and so, and this belonged to my great-grandmother, and it has a name, and you're just sitting on it, like, you're not going to sit on my face, why are you sitting on my rock, you know? And, I mean, everything, and so whenever they do anything, before you do it, like the fire, for instance, you say certain words before you even approach to cook, and you say certain words to your granny stone before you approach to cook, and when you're done, and so there's all kinds of ways of showing praise, also by the way you move, which happens to turn into superstition in modern life when you lose the story of why you do it and taboo. So for instance, like if a young woman is combing her hair, you know, they like to comb their hair really nice, and they have these very fancy combs, and another girl wants to borrow the comb, that girl won't throw her the comb. If she throws the comb, that's like really, really bad juju. The thing is, she goes over and she puts her breath on the comb and gives to the other lady and tells the name of the comb. So that when she combs her hair, because the idea of a girl combing her hair, as she combs her hair, her mind is supposed to be such, she's the same as the moon, and every hair strand is an umbilical cord at the end of which is a living being in the earth. So by combing her hair, she brings life into the world. So they will say, Tehkawa, Tehkawa Hakate. Says, comb your hair, grandmother, comb your hair, grandmother. And so if you throw the comb against, it means you're trying to throw this person away from you magically, throw her out of reality. So, but when you give to her, it means you're showing love for this process. So, you know, I mean, this is vast. I mean, why a man walks this way, where he puts his axe when he's coming, and he won't step over a woman's weaving. The women do this, the men do that. And the little kids, of course, in this vast college of why you do this and why you don't do that. Not because if you do this, it's bad and we're all going to go to hell. It's because the sun will die, the moon will die, the earth will die, our food will no longer grow. You can't argue in front of corn seeds. You know, all of these things, even though they're not, those are unspoken ones, but that's the way they show praise for these beings to remember them. And so the idea of remembering, shkanata, as they say, is the same as the word for being able to be fed. So everybody says, did you remember such and such? I mean, you praise it. So that's kind of what it looks like. And I mean, it's constant. It's just constant. And then as soon as somebody dies, it's the same. And if you can't get it out of your system, you know, if your tears are locked up, which many of us, this happens, we get in shock. They got these people that come and they have the words to make. Pretty soon yours are rolling too. And everyone's going. But it's never a lonesome thing of one little person sitting up there crying in the rain. You're always surrounded by tons of people. But, you know, they put that all to rest with all of the quote-unquote so-called modernity, which I'm always saying doesn't have to be that way. So here I am, you know, barking away like a fool as usual. But
well, it's—I mean, what's so interesting to me about this book? I mean, if you grow up in a scientific worldview, and there's a lot of, I think, good that comes from a scientific worldview.
Yeah, absolutely.
The sun comes up without our help, and it always came up without our help. Mm. We are a very recent arrival on this earth, and so that idea that, in some deep way, nature is responding to and even dependent on human activity and thought. It's foreign to the scientific way of thinking, but it's not only poetic, it's profound in a way that you're writing book after book to try to get at.
I am writing book after book, unfortunately. But no, I think that's absolutely right, and so many people go, well, that's very quaint, it's very beautiful, it's very poetic, but we really don't have to get up early in the morning to feed the sun, because the sun doesn't need us. The native people don't say the sun needs us. This is not what I was saying earlier, actually. What I was saying is that for the amount of carbon unit energy expenditure that we pull out of the world for the shape and form as a human being that we have decided to become with the scientific application into technology, then there has to be some response to that vacuous hole that we create by doing so. And therefore, the psyche of a human being falls into this deep depression, which is, you know, rampant at this time, because it has no response, no place to respond, because the psyche is not a scientific thing. It's a natural thing. And so it's not that nature depends on us, but we're depending on nature. When we take that much from, if we do not give that much back, at least with what we have to offer, because we don't have a lot to offer natural world. Everything we have comes from the natural world. So we do have, as human beings, it's pretty amazing, at least in my mind. So we have our thumbs, opposable thumbs. Most of us are blessed with thumbs. We can make things, which has also gone by the wayside. And then we have this beautiful capacity for language and singing. And so that's basically where praise ends up being, whatever you're making with your hands to give as an offering to holy, or whatever you can speak as beauty or sing. Therefore, all art among these native peoples with the grief and praise does not end up being an art that is necessarily for an entertainment or for people to get a jolt or a feeling, but as a gift to something that has already been given to us. Not as like, oh, I'm worried the sun doesn't gonna come up tomorrow. I'm worried that the sun didn't get fed from what happened 10 years ago. And so humans are humans, you know, and it's not about just making mistakes, but they're always going on this way and that way and falling apart and forgetting, getting angry and jealous. And the difference is not that the people are better, these old-time people or intact people are any better people. There's some real rascals there. But they know that they're like this. And therefore, being able to live a life on a daily basis makes your scientific decisions different. You see, and so the motivation for why you would make this technology, as opposed to this technology, I just all of a sudden reminded by these kids. I was a lot of friends with kids who were very left-wing, very rational, trying to be rationalist Indians in Guatemala, and they brought in a water pump, I remember one day, a great big giant machine, you know, they're supposed to run on diesel, so that the girls didn't have to haul water, because the girls all haul water from the lake, so they could pipe water in all the houses to the council, you know, and I happened to be a part of the council at the time, but I was a very junior member, and all these old duffers and these old ladies are sitting there really decked out and watching, smoking their cigars and listening to this rap of these young guys making their case. And they said, where was this machine born? And they said, well, we don't know. Said, well, we better find out where his parents are or who invented it. And what does it eat? It eats this thing. So, yeah, but we don't have any of that and we don't know how to make it. He says, yeah, but that will take cash to get. But when the revolution comes, you know, we won't need cash for that. And so, okay, well, that's fine. And so all the old people said, you know what I think? I think we could probably have a pretty good idea what you guys have, but let's leave this pump here in front of the council for the next few years as it grows up. So when it comes to maturity, when it's ready, you know, we know how to talk to it because we don't know yet, and we know who his mom and pop are, then probably we can put it into work. But let's just watch this invention and not just adopt it because it's there. So everybody on the outside thought this was really kind of droll, and actually some people thought it was stupid. I thought it was brilliant to sit there and wait for an invention to show itself to be useful, just sitting there for a long time, and let's just get used to it being in our face before we adopt it.
And what happened?
The gorillas went off and became gorillas, got their AKs, and they started fighting. They forgot all about the pump, and then most of them old people were killed, and half of my friends were killed, and both sides were idiots about the whole thing, and here I am. So it's you read the other books, you can hear all the inside of that, but or at least a percentage. But the thing is that the idea that loss can bring life, as opposed to it just being something you got to get through in order to get on with the modern world that keeps digging more holes to fill the last one it dug.
Well, you write in the book, and I'm probably paraphrasing it badly, but basically the idea that all culture could and maybe should arise from grief and love, that idea of turning grief into beauty, of grief and praise becoming the culture that we live.
Well, I think all culture really wants to be something like that, and I don't think it should be a single culture. I think it should be many, many cultures with many, many flavors. And I think there are people throughout the world, I know people, excuse me, who are involved with that and who are doing that. But as far as grief itself, I really don't even like to use the word that much because it ends up being in English, you know, grief, 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 ends up becoming a concept instead of it being the origination place. For instance, if you're planting a seed, you know, I'm a big seed guy, that's one of my big things, and I remember the guys would ask the seeds if they wanted to be planted, ask their permission. And if they get a dream that seemed to lean that direction, then they went ahead. But then when they planted, they wept. They didn't like go, oh, don't, we're planting all our corn, you know, marching around like a bunch of Smurfs. They they're planting the corn and then they weep. It says, because what they say to the seeds before they put in the ground says, are you willing to die for the appearance of human culture? In other words, you're no longer going to be with us, and you're going to, if you were lucky and you sprout into a plant and don't get, you know, washed out by some kind of flood, when you come into being, you will no longer be what you were, and are you willing to go through that for us? And that was the question that was always being asked, whether it was responded to or not, or the people could hear is one thing. It was a kind of Parsevalian thing. That question must be asked. Is this metal willing to be extracted from taconite in order to make this many missiles to blow up so-and-so in order to defend the way of life that's untenable or not, you know? And so when you start to phrase things like that, then realize your culture and your motivating factors in your groups and your congresses and, you know, your councils and all that take on a different smell and taste altogether, you see? And it's not sadness, and it's not beating yourself in the back. It's like, you know, life doesn't need to be like always a constant state of emergency. It could be a constant state of involvement with what you're surrounded by, you know, instead of running away all the time.
I wanted to talk to you also about war, because that's a subject that you talk about a lot in the book. And we can talk about war, we can talk about gang violence, we can talk about vengeance, right. But the origins of these activities are really important to understand.
Well, I mean, that's an enormous subject, which of course is not really covered by the book, the origins of them, but the ongoing, constant, pervasive presence of them is another thing. War, I mean, you got to redefine war. I mean, war now, what it is nothing like a bunch of guys going out on a raid to steal some horses and incidentally killing one person and coming back and being heroes in the village. Now it's, you know, run by countries, and you usually have a business motive behind their killing, and you know, which is being carried out by guys that want to get a college education to make more money, to have, you know, family, and, you know, no longer, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But grief is the pervasive thing in war. I mean, if you've ever seen any war, I hope you don't have to. I have seen more than I want and been part of it. The sadness, just the immensity of the destruction that happens during warfare, as far as what I learned and what I grew up with and concerned with, is the fact that when you kill, if you kill, or you destroy when another person's been worked so hard to make, you become entangled spiritually with the one you killed. In other words, you don't like blow this guy away and then you're done with it. Well, that person's soul now becomes your charge. And so anything that you attack, you become entangled with. And unless that is addressed in such a way so that the grief of the loss of that person or situation is made well so that there is more life, then that haunts the people that kill or the culture of the people who ask them to kill or both. So this is not so simple. You say, okay, so we praise the enemy? No, this is not what we're talking about, praising the enemy or not praising the enemy. We're talking about life itself. Where when you have a situation in war, there is no time to grieve. And if you're being a soldier, you know, on command, a man or a woman this day and age, saying, okay, you got to do this, you know, you got to send this many missiles over here, do this, or mop up this, or go guard this thing, you know, and so steps out, you blow them. And if you're being asked to do that, you know, it's like you can't expect this person, if they kill somebody and see what they've done, to be able to grieve that by the next day. I mean, there's no time. You know, the incoming is coming, you're putting back on the front, you're on there. Nor can you have time to grieve when they kill your best friend. Nor, and this is the worst part of it all, do you have any person left to do the grieving once you've done the killing, because half of you is missing. Because as soon as you start to become a person who's involved in warfare, even in the planning stages of it, you begin to lose more and more of who you were to begin with. So let's say you come home, and everybody knows the stories, everybody has a relative or seen it happen, you know, how it is in the family. The guys that get blown up, not with so much with the explosives, but are being shot through or losing limbs, they work through it because they've lost a piece. But the people that haven't lost those things, they lost their minds, they have the rest of them floating out there in the battlefield. So Mayans and the people I grew up with here in New Mexico as well, they understood that you're missing this piece, so somebody else has to supply that for you. Or what's going to happen is it's going to be endless war. Because as long as you become a half a person, that other soul is going to be wandering, that part of the piece is going to be wandering around and starts to make basically a phantom psyche, that it has to have a home and it has no home, And in order to feed what it needs to take, it starts to eat the people's living existence. So what the old-time people would say was that there would have to be a human, a non-combatant person who doesn't know how to fight or anything, would adopt one of these homecoming individuals and become the other half for them. And they would both lose their original identities for a period of time until both of them were initiated as what you might call twins. And they both gained each other's other half. And then became actually healers of the instance of having killed when some others are doing this. And this is not only with war, it was also with, like car accidents or falling off a building or any sort of technology that blew up in somebody's face, considered the same thing. And I always found that like brilliant, you know. I was like, wow, that's amazing, you know, that could even be done. But if that could take place, then these people would become the healers of the society instead of the perpetrators of more war. Otherwise, it's going to be constantly, we've got to have another war to have enough bloodshed in order to feed the hole that was created by this first one that was never grieved by the people on either side of the fracas. You look at this, you know, like Armenians or the Ashkenazi Jews or the different peoples have always gone on and on, tried to figure this out, and then, you know, end up becoming in another fracas. Them, we're not singling out because they're not the only people. There's thousands of people. I grew up with lots of native people. It was a similar situation. So when it comes to warfare, I noticed that it became like the principle is like a black hole, where the actual sucking of the person, it was almost invisible, but it had the weight of one half of the universe. So it would be pulling all of this energy back in and taking out the people, and the people get scared, and so they work even more hard to get an untenable culture that is going at light speed away from staying put in a place and grieving its losses in such a way that gives life.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting when you talk about that. We have in our language the phrase becoming whole.
Yeah, right.
And yeah, that's probably what it's referring to.
God willing, yeah.
But what really strikes me is, I mean, there are a lot of soldiers who come back and they are a mess and they are not whole and they could probably benefit by the kinds of things you're talking about. But the people who are the perpetrators, you know, those business people and the politicians, they seem not to feel anything, and they go about their lives happily and die at the age of 96 surrounded by a loving family.
They don't, most of them die at 96, I can vouch for that. But, yeah, I understand the bitterness in your tone, and mine is exactly the same, that the people who are the perpetrators of this habit are deferring their grief onto another generation who will suffer that. And that goes mostly to the poor people. And I got a really good sentence in this book, if you want to hear it.
Yeah.
One sentence. It's a good sentence. You know, I even read this book. My other books I never read. It says, only nations capable of the true art of grief, grieving their mistakes and deeply felt losses they have endured or have caused to happen, can say that they are not pools of emotional stagnation dressed up in the spoils of ungrieved wars, disguised as good business, heaping their unwept tears upon the poor and struggling as the currency of poverty. And that's exactly what you were just talking about, if I got it right.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's not just or anything like that, but you know, it's like Einstein theory, you know, that grief doesn't disappear. Just because so-and-so looks like they have happiness, doesn't mean they're happy, because they can't be happy if they don't know how to grieve. So what they are is they're functioning on a stoned level, whether it's with substances or with this kind of euphoria of business, constant forward motion, but they're deferring the grief onto another people and most likely onto another time beyond ourselves. Well, a lot of kids, they're born with anxiety the minute they come out of the womb, but they don't have any motivation to have that. There's no stimuli, but it's in the air, you know. So I read this, you know, mostly because I get so many love letters from the most unlikely places, you know, lesbian right-wing judges from Nebraska. You know, you would say, is there such a thing? There is, you know. Prisoners, I have a beautiful group of guys. I don't have them. They have themselves. But in Soledad Prison, 60 guys, this is their, every morning they get up, they're doing this book and the tape. From all over the world. Fishermen, ladies, you know, just lost little women, been left alone in the farms. All kinds of things. Powerful people, not powerful people. And I couldn't believe they all benefit from this thought that, you know, if I can express some grief, I'm not killing the world. In the world, maybe a little bit happening, you know. So I just wrote it. Not like it's a great book, but I loved writing it, and I like writing it for the people, and I like the fact that people love it. So, for a change.
We're talking to Martin Prechtel about his book, The Smell of... I can always get it wrong.
That's all right. Dust on rain would be good, too.
No, no, I'm going to get it right. I'm going to edit. The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. And I wanted to talk about animals, because there's a really beautiful chapter in the book about animals and the way, the roles that animals play in our lives and the way that they help us to grieve, to change, to find a kind of beauty. And I wanted to ask you before we get into that, because I was thinking about vengeance and the whole cycle of war and vengeance that people have. Is vengeance unique to human beings? Do animals have vengeance?
No, some animals have revenge.
Do they?
Remember those tigers in San Diego Zoo? I don't know about exactly revenge, but they definitely have some vengeance. Some animals do, yeah. Bears, I've seen it very much so. And they have that deep grief too, deep capacity for grief.
Yeah.
I remember this guy, these two punks were taunting a tiger in the zoo, a couple of tigers in the zoo, and they did a bad thing to these tigers. With absolute foolishness. And then they left, and they went off into the streets and were at some concession stand. The tiger just jumped right out of the pen, tracked them all through the street till they went right to where he was getting their little ice cream cone, push, and killed the one guy and started walking back to the zoo.
Oh, my goodness.
And they shot the tiger, and I was like, yeah, right on, man. Not to be sounding like one of those guys, I am one of those guys. And I said, man, can you believe the big heart? The tiger knew he was going to get killed. He knew, and he knew he probably shouldn't go out there, but he said, no, I have to. Because he dishonored totally the magnificence of this tiger, who obviously was not in the zoo because he couldn't get out. He was there doing it because he had agreed to. And I've seen with bears too. I've seen mama bears in particular. You try to hurt one of their cub, and if you do, they don't care. They'll die doing it, and they're going to have revenge, and they'll kill everything in their sight. I saw a mother jaguar do that in Guatemala. She just tore up, killed every cow, everything she could find, until she could find her baby. And when she did, then she was still not exactly... convinced that she shouldn't keep killing everything in sight. So, yeah, I think some animals do. And I personally hold animal very, very heavy, very high. I kneel before animal. You know, like before I milk my cow, I say, please adopt me, because I'm the one that ate your calf and I'm the one who steal its milk. Please let me kneel in front of you. But I don't think humans can live without animal. I think it's impossible to be, like, even marginally sane if there's no animals with us, you know.
Yeah, and you talked both about our pets, like our dogs and cats, and wild animals.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't know. You've been around a lot of places. I'm sure you've seen it. Like you go to the islands, different islands in the Philippines and different places in South America, Guatemala one time, up in the Lacandon, I used to see. The people, you know, they live with agriculture, but there's a lot of them, they kill animals to eat too. And a lot of times the animals will be in their field, and they will kill one, and then they have to go look for the... If they see it's a mother, they have to go... And then the mother, they're feeding to the children. If it's a monkey or whatever kind, then they go look for the children that are being left stranded by this death. And then they adopt that child into their family. This used to be the case. All northern people, all Europeans used to do this, you know, thousands of years ago. They were always raising bears in their house. And so the pet... And in a lot of these people's houses, the wild dogs and everything, are usually from... the fact that the parent has been killed in order to feed the people, but the people don't see the killing of the animal in the same way as like, oh, I'm killing this pest, or I'm getting rid of this thing I don't want. They don't see it that way at all. They see it as much as they do as when they take a corn off the stalk. They say, well, this beautiful mother is feeding my children, but then I better feed her children. And so you end up with these baby animals. I used to see monkeys at women's breasts, you know, wild dog at women's breasts. I would see, as a matter of fact, with Mayans, when little girls start to bud and like become pubescent, they will always want a wild animal to suckle so that their breasts would develop in order to give milk to the baby. And, you know, the priests and all of the scientific people thought this was a ghastly idea and how horrible. And as a matter of fact, when they wrote that in here, you know, some of the publishers were like, oh, my God, that's horrible. I said, what do you mean? It's a little baby animal drinking the mama's milk. Because the belief is, if I drink your milk, you drink my milk, then we're blood, we can't fight. That's how you make peace. You know, and a lot of people don't realize, like in Europe, this when you kneel in front of the king or lift up the queen's hem and she blesses you, that's what that comes from, because the old warriors used to come and they would kiss the breasts of the queen as if they were brothers with her own children. And then after that, they couldn't fight and all blood feuds were off. See, and that was the end of the revenge. So pets in the house, I mean, nobody's doing that anymore. Like in America, forget it. But I mean, it's still the feeling of I mean, you've seen, I mean, people, they lose their own parents or their best friend and they can hardly weep. And then there's their little dog they've had for 15 years, gets very old, you know, and just doing what they can, absorbing all the trouble in the house, and finally keels over. And these people, they're very good grievers. You know, all of a sudden, it's like, oh my God, I've lost the best thing in my life. But then, sometime, all the grief for all the other things that you've ever lost, too, some, they all join in, you know. They're not like holding back, it's just everything flies out. And so an animal, I just have to put that in. I just, Mary Oliver just wrote me, you know, the poet, Mary Oliver, she wrote me a nice endorsement, and she sent it yesterday. It took her 6 months to do it, and she's 84 or something. She's a nice lady. She loves...
Wonderful poet. Yeah.
Yeah, she loves animals, you know, more than anything else. And that's what we were talking about, you know. So I didn't put a lot in there about animals, but I put some so that people of animals know that, you know, what they're doing, and also not to not to feel left out. You know?
Well, and animals are so much our connection to the basics.
Yeah, to being a human.
Yeah.
Being a human.
To being alive, to being, I mean, eating, sleeping, running around, loving and sniffing each other.
Everything.
That's pretty much
everything. I have horses, I have cows, I have goats, chicken, I have a cat's having a baby right now, and little children, and I have a school, and you know, like, all these animals are there all the time, and I won't have it no other way, because I just feel so, I get scared in cities where there's no animal, and if there's animal, it's okay, because I'm more animal than any person, let's face it, you know.
Well, we're all animals.
Yeah, and eating and sleeping and all of these things, a lot of people trivialize animals, some animals are extremely heavy, no, shaman. You know, like a lot of these kids come to me, I want to be a shaman, you know, I want to learn to be a shaman. So, well, that's good. Go somewhere where they teach it, you know, I'm not going to do it. But they know nothing about natural world and nothing about animals and nothing about plants. Because if you know about animals, you also got to know about plants. I left the whole chapter about plants out of here because I'd just written a gigantic book on plants. And I thought, oh, gee, all I need to do is terrorize everybody with that. But animals take you to plants eventually because of the way things are in this world. So, and you know, people and their dogs, people and their cats, you know, they're living in these little cubicles, in these little apartments, in this little kind of place where they got to walk in the park. That's their only, like, little breath of the reality of being an animal themselves, you know. So, yeah, that they know how to grieve. Animal, they ain't got no problem with it, you know. Just let her loose, you know. You see an animal lose his partner, like a dog?
Yeah.
I have these big sheepdogs, you know. One of them dies, you know, they get killed by coyotes or something. Oh, my 5 days, man, they're just down, they're howling, they're so sad. And, I mean, it's deep, you know, and you feel it, and you weep too, because you just hear it inside your heart, you know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're talking to Martin Prechta. There are some wonderful stories in the book, and one of them is about the little shell and the big thunder. I was wondering if you might want to tell us that story.
Oh, to tell the story? Oh, Lord, it's pretty long. That's funny. Like that's one chapter that divides the sheep from the goats with all the people, because some people, they, you know, they're business people, they hate it, and other people love it. You know, I get a lot of people digging it. It's a Yurok story. Yurok people, they're from North what now is known as California, and I heard it on the, actually, right, I was just there last week, day before yesterday, and the beach of Trinidad. And where the little river comes in, it's called the Little River. They used to dig clam there. It's now owned by, you know, pretty much white American, but the descendant of Europe, people live around there. And so Ophel told that story to me, and I heard it first time, and I could barely hear because the wind was really high. I couldn't believe what he was telling me. You know, it's just, because they have money in the old days called dentelia, in English called dentelia, but they call the little one is a wetzak, and the big one's a tsago. And the story of thunder, and I don't want to make it short, but too long for our interviews. Thunder was they have a belief and understanding, like many people do, that the world originally without human beings was inhabited by all kinds of other beings, all of whom retired to another dimension, in their case, out in the ocean, at the time of the appearance of human beings. But a certain number of these very magical beings didn't leave, and thunder was one of them, and Wetzak was another one of them. It's a tiny little shell. Their shape, I don't know if you've ever seen dentelium shell, the wetzak is only about 3/4 inch long when it's big, whereas the other dentelium about 1.5 inches. And it's just tiny little end, and then opening maybe, if you're lucky, to find one 1/4 inch wide. and they go vertically, you know, and they don't occur where the Yurok people are. So they only saw them through trade, and so that's called, they, it means they walked the river. So the idea is this was money, but it wasn't money like you can get 3 shells in order to buy a loaf of bread or something. It was the kind of money that gave wealth. When you had this much dentalium shell, you had enough wherewithal in order to get people to loan you all the outfits in order to do all the rituals in order to keep the world back alive. So it's a little bit different. But anyway, the story goes it wasn't money to begin with. And Thunder had a son who was beautiful. And so he never cut him in, never told him to watch out for himself because Thunder was more powerful than anything in the world. And so the sun went everywhere in the world, thought nobody would touch him because I'd kill anybody. You know, I'm so powerful. I'm the United States. You know, I got all the bombs, all the money, and all the positions, and all the connections. No one's going to bother my son. Well, the sun disappears, and he is killed. But he's not killed by violence. He's killed by sickness, and he disappears actually as a substance. Which, if you know about thunder, it's how it goes boom, and disappears. And so the thunder goes all over the world trying to find him, and no one can tell him a thing. The only one that knows is this little tiny shell. And Thunder's beating up the world after this. Oh, they're all lying to me. So he starts killing everybody. And then he starts to feel his grief deeper. And instead of his grief and weeping, he starts murdering and killing and altering and cutting up canyons and chopping down trees and blowing everything to bits with his, basically, his enormous electrical energy, equivalent of an atomic bomb. And he's done about 90% of the world when the little shell's, you know, squeaking away. Listen, I know what happened. Stop already. You're going to destroy the whole world. You can't do anything about it. And then Thunder can't hear him. So he finally finds a voice. This little shell finds a voice that's loud enough. And Thunder says, you little pipsqueak, you don't know anything. You're nothing. You're small. You're an idiot. Now what could you know about something as great as my son? And he says, let me tell you, I know. And he says, and he tells him, you know, go to hell, you know. And so the little shell finally says, okay, you're going to be like that? I'm going to be like that too. So the shell starts to eat the remaining part of the world and starts sucking in the whole world, starts disappearing into this tiny little mouth of 1/4-inch wide. And after about 51, as they say, you know, very blithely, this old guy said 51% of the world was missing, of what was remained. Thunder freaked out. He said, wait a minute, my even existence where I can be angry is going to disappear. There'll be total oblivion. He says, stop. And he says, why should I stop? You won't stop. And he says, no, stop, stop. If you stop, I'll stop. And so the shell stops eating the world. And Thunder says, okay, I'll stop. What happened to my son? You know. So the story, you can tell it's a little moralistic, but the story says, once the biggest thing in the world would listen to the smallest thing in the world, the smallest people, the people no one pays any attention to, who don't have the money, but are the money. That the people who are the poor are the actual currency that the rich are spending and using up. So he still has half of the universe inside him. And so what the Yurok end up doing is they end up having a situation what they call grief money or blood money, which was also extant in Europe at some point. And there a certain amount of the shell money was given to transfer for the loss that had been incurred by one tribe to another so that it wouldn't keep blood feuds going in revenge. But the interesting thing at the end of the story, the guy says, well, Thunder then told everybody, all the humans when they came, he says, you must accept this. Because if you don't accept this compensation of this littlest thing listening, then what's going to happen is you're going to have endless wars and then the world's going to end, just like what I was doing to it. But if you accept it, make sure you hide your money and don't use it. Because every time you look at it, all you're going to be is struck with sorrow. So only take it out every once in a while and look and remember what happened and then put it away again. Don't spend it. So the whole idea is that money, as far as these guys are concerned, is actually grief transferred from one generation to the other. And nowadays it's used in order to avoid grieving and to buy yourself out of the debt with the grief of the past, which is, if you put that together, ramifications of that psychologically is pretty hefty. So anyway, that's my little business chapter, which is getting me in plenty of trouble, but I don't mind.
No, it's I love that story. It's metaphorical and on so many levels.
Heavy duty, man. Yeah, there's versions of it written by Alfred Kroeber, but they're kind of dry, you know. They don't have the cool stuff in there. You know?
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, it's time to go, but yeah. I want to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. Martin Prechtel is an author, he's an artist, he's founder of the school Bolad's Kitchen, and his new book is The Smell of Rain on Dust, Grief and Praise. He will be speaking tonight, Wednesday, the 15th of July, at 7 o'clock at the Embudo Valley Library in Dixon, New Mexico. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for letting me be with you. Blessings on everyone.
And for more information on Martin Prechtel, you can go to the website floweringmountain.com. Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to Studio X for their technical support and web design.